This episode of The Luminaries on Deep in the Weeds is proudly supported by Deputy, rostering and timesheets without the usual chaos.
I guess if you're going to be competitive in this environment, you need to make sure that you've got enough juice in the tank, obviously financially, but also emotionally and physically to see it through, because it's a hard game. You know, there's no easy service.
This is The Luminaries on the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Australia's coffee culture is considered one of the most mature on the planet, triggered by waves of coffee-loving migrants and allowed to blossom and evolve in groundbreaking cafes as one of our most important means of social interaction. There have been some that have carved a path and set a benchmark to ensure cafes and coffee remain an integral part of our lives. Salvatore Malatesta is the owner of St. Ali in Melbourne. Salvatore, how are you?
I'm amazing. And thank you so much for having me on your amazing show.
Well, you're known, and St. Ali is known as really the beating heart of coffee in Melbourne. How does it feel to be talked about in that way?
It comes with, thank you, that's very kind words. It does come with a sense of enormous responsibility, to be honest, and there is a lot of anxiety around being judged continuously. So as I've got older, I'm almost 50, I probably, don't quite care as much in terms of reading every review. I sort of feel comfortable in our own skin. And I remember watching Prince, in his concert where he started a few songs, and then he said, "I've got so many hits, I'm not sure where to start." And I guess when you get older, you think, well, we've been around almost 20 fucking years, so if you don't like what we do, well, fuck off. But that's not entirely true. You still have a little bit of anxiety because, I mean, you're in hospo and retail, you're only as good as last week, right? So there's always a cooler dog, a bigger dog, a faster dog, and remaining relevance being our thing. But I think where I've done a fair bit of therapy as well, mate. So I've reached this point through lots of work, but I think I find I'm not a name and shamer, but there are a few people that literally cut and paste what we do and present it as their own. We've got one in particular who literally cuts and pastes, like it's pure plagiarism. And whilst some people say flattery is the greatest form of whatever the expression is, your greatest form of flattery or something, it's a little bit annoying. But I think we like to think of ourselves as innovating continuously. And so hopefully if we innovate fast enough, it's harder to catch us. So how does it feel? It feels – and the other thing, I guess, that I've thought a lot about is I don't feel like St. Ali belongs to us anymore, to be honest. I think it's a bit like the ESPY in that it belongs to Melbourne. And if there was a way to donate it to Melbourne, on my passing, I would. Because unfortunately cafes need people to run them, so you can't just donate the cafes. But we've over the years, we've been the poster boys and girls for, Tourism Australia, Tourism Victoria. We toured with the last big day out with Ken West, and we were the official coffee makers for the Red Hot Chili Peppers. We toured with them, nationally. The stuff, we've done some really cool stuff over 18 or so years. It feels great. I mean, that was a long answer, wasn't it? Sorry about that.
Well, we like long answers on podcasts. Well, take us back. There's so many stories that I'd love to touch on, but take us back to where it all started. Like, where did the interest in coffee start for you?
So, coffee is a, and people often forget this, it's a drug of dependence, right? So it's not, if you're a coffee drinker and you give it up, you feel nauseous and get headaches. So it's something that once you're on, right? But also it's a cultural voice. And that's something else people forget about as well. So, you know, if a lot of people, particularly in Australia, understand coffee as espresso, you know, from a La Marzocco coffee machine. But if you're from, you know, Copenhagen, it's always been about filter, batch brew. And if you're from Tokyo, it's been about, you know, cold drip or siphon. And if you're in Italy, it's been about stovetop and so forth. So culturally, coffee has a massive impact and influence in the landscape. And for me, I mean, from my name should be a giveaway, but we're Italian migrants. So given that I've given an attempt at explaining that coffee is very much culturally dependent, it makes sense that for me, with my Italian background, coffee was going to be very much part of my life forever. And as cliche as this sounds, it's true. Italian toddlers are given coffee in milk, yeah. Maybe a teaspoon or half a teaspoon. It's all sort of part of the tea ceremony or coffee ceremony in this case. And so for me, that smell, and I don't know if you've experienced this with anything before, but whenever I have a particular single state, single origin microlot or particular blend of coffee, it's transporting. So it has a very powerful psychedelic transporting. So for me, you know, coffee was so much part of my everyday that it was only inevitable that it would become of interest. Now, when I got involved in HOSPO, I went through, you know, some formal training, some good restaurants. I went to William Angus College, hotel management and catering, before I did a law degree. And so I was always going to be in HOSPO. I think at one point when I was 17 or 18, I thought about, I probably want to be a concierge at a, you know, at a interesting hotel where I could have some fun with interesting guests. And then, you know, coffee got a hold, and I opened my first cafe when I was 19 years old or 20 years old, just on 20. So I was studying arts law at the University of Melbourne, and I was majoring in philosophy in my arts degree, and consequently had a lot of people with a lot of time on their hands. And I got a lot of help from a lot of friends, and I opened a cafe on campus back then called Caffeine. And, you know, there was a few things that we did which were, in hindsight, probably ludicrous, but at the time, perfectly sensible. So we had techniques and vinyl at lunchtime at a university cafe, right? So I went very quickly. I went from living in Park Street, Brunswick, in a share house with seven people, working on a casual hourly rate, to owning this really busy cafe. And coffee was the anchor for the offering. And it opened my eyes as to perhaps hospitality could be more than just a passion. It could also provide you know, a career option and some other opportunities. And that's what happened. And not in a million years would I have thought that's necessarily where my trajectory would have been, but that's, I mean, it has a strong hold, right, coffee?
Take us back to that time with that cafe. Cafes have changed so much since then. What's it been like being part of the evolution of the cafe culture here?
You know, that I always there's always a reference to the, you know, the golden era of porn. You're wondering where I'm going with this, but it's I think I was in the golden era of HOSPO, you know, a sort of Anthony Bourdain hospitality, which I realize now with some enlightenment and self-work that hospitality burnt people out and came with a lot of demons and came with a lot of issues, you know, the long shifts, double shifts, that kind of HOSPO. And, you know, we probably should never go back there again, but that's the hospitality that I was brought up in. And so I remember, you know, my first or second shift as a section waiter in a restaurant that I'll keep confidential for the moment. The head chef was pretty keen on terrorizing everybody and ran that kitchen in the way that you might think old brigades used to work. But that was the hospitality that I knew, and that was the one that I was brought up in. And whilst it was tough and it wasn't for everyone, and there were plenty of dead bodies along the way, metaphorically, it was one that we all understood and loved. And I think hospitality has changed from that. And back then it was sort of chef or restaurateur driven. So there was always the restaurateur or and the chef. And then it became less about the restaurateur and became about the chef. And then it became about the chef and groups. And then it became about the chef groups and banks. And then it became, you know, larger groups and sort of Excel sheet plays, if you know. And that's not the restaurants that any of us actually listening want to go to. I mean, we want to go to the restaurants that are the chef-driven or restaurateur-driven and cares in the detail. But it's just become a bit more like the Vegas model in that large groups own lots of restaurants. And there's very few that can pull that off and make them good. Now, we're lucky enough to have a couple in Melbourne that do and doing a great job. But that's sort of the hospitality as I remember. And then what we have now, so then I drilled down into coffee specifically. So whilst it's the hospitality, I mean, what our main business is sourcing, roasting and supplying, you know, excellent coffee beans. So we can do that without running a restaurant. And we can do that, you know, there are no limits, but there are sort of no limits as to who you can sell to and how far you can go and so forth. So it's a different business, I guess, to the one I started and got involved in.
Let's go back to that time and what you were like back then. What were some of the sort of challenges and adversities that sort of and failures that you had and lessons, but you grew from it?
Oh, there were plenty of failures and plenty of lessons. I mean, look, I think the biggest, I had two gifts, I think, when I started out. One was poverty. So there wasn't much to lose. So it didn't really matter what happened, really, you know. And the other one was inexperience and self-confidence. So I thought I could do it, right? Like I remember winning that tender at Melbourne Uni and I had $18,000 saved. And I thought that was enough to open a cafe. It clearly wasn't. And then as I juggled and moved things around and, you know, begged and sort of that kind of stuff, for me, it was exciting to learn on the go and just go for it. And the good thing about being young and doing it, and, you know, to anyone who's thinking about opening a business, the best time to do it is as soon as you can, because you don't actually have anything to lose, right? Once you've jumped on the trajectory and you've got kids and dependents and stuff, well, then you're sort of compromising other people. But when you're 19 and 20, I mean, I was living in a share house with seven people. So the worst thing that could happen was I was living in a share house with seven people. That was going to be the worst. So, and the worst was pretty good. So it wasn't that bad. So I know that if I had my time again, would I do anything differently? Look, probably not, because I probably wouldn't have done it. If someone had told me the business plan and the Excel spreadsheet and what I needed to do to break even, I would have said, oh, I'm not going to do that. That's a silly idea. So because I didn't have time to think about it, we just did it. And we got lucky, you know. And one of the things I've always said in lots of interviews is that the reason for the success in the early days was that I was always the end user of the product. So I kind of understood the market. Back in the day, I don't know if you went to uni in Victoria, but back then and maybe still now or maybe even more so now, Melbourne Uni was considered, you know, best in category for a lot of things. And the offering on campus in terms of food and beverage was, you know, fried dim sims and 600ml bottles of Coke. And, I remember every day we used to walk off campus and go and eat at Tiamo's or whatever because, you know, we didn't want a dim sim and a bottle of Coke every day. And so it wasn't difficult for me to conceptualize and know that a cafe on campus was probably going to be successful because, you know, 100 of us would walk off from my faculty every day to go and buy coffee and stuff off campus, right? And back then when I, you know, I remember approaching my brother saying, can I borrow some money? I've got this idea. I want to open a cafe on campus. The standard position back then was that's the most ludicrous idea ever. Students don't have any money. Who are you going to sell food to? And I said, students always have money for drugs and parties, and they always have money for coffee and festivals. They don't have money for rent and food, you know. And that was the approach that I took, and it was kind of right, you know. Like people would always part with money for good coffee, and we were always, you know, more expensive than everybody else. I remember, you know, we opened at La Trobe Uni 1 year, and I think coffee was $1.70 or something before we opened in the student cafe, and we were at $3.50, which was considered, you know, like $8 today or something, you know. We had, you know, queues all day long, and students would thank us for being open. Like rather than resent the $3.50, they'd be like, thank you so much for this. This is awesome, you know. And so it was like we were always pioneering and reaching out the lands that people didn't believe in. And for a while there, some of my now peers used to enjoy in making jokes at my expense about being the university king until they realized universities were a great place to be in. And by that stage, I'd done 15 venues in university, so I was quite happy. Not to mention that I don't know if you, like I said, what uni you went to, but it's a hotbed for political thought and enthusiasm, right? Or was then anyway. So you're around people who are love challenging, love experimenting. Like, what an environment. And once you're back in the day at Melbourne Uni, once you're on campus, it was like being on the moon. Like, it didn't matter what happened outside. It was like this sort of gated community of, you know, committed academics. So it was good fun.
Tell us about the beginnings of St. Ali and how you pulled it together.
Yeah, there's lots of stories about this. So I think we should put a nice circle of truth around it. I mean, the truth is, there's you know, and often people run with some strange conspiracy theories. And the truth is, back in the day, a couple of guys got together, and none of those guys was me. And one of those guys was Coffee Supreme, and one of them was Mark Dundon, about opening this micro roastery in South Melbourne. And Supreme pulled out, and then Mark went balls deep on his own. And I remember it was like third week or something of him being open. And a friend of mine who owns a business called Soul Fresh, his name is Dee Dee, and now he's a CEO of Soul Fresh, but was back then a one-man sort of business. He rang me up and he said, dude, you've got to check out this cafe. It's unbelievable. It's in a garage in a laneway. And I was like, I think I was about 36, and I was kind of I don't want to say semi-retired, but I'd sold some things and having a break. And I remember walking in thinking, and by the way, Sinali didn't look like it looks now. Like, it was literally a bench and a 5-kilo, a really renegade rep. But I remember thinking, this guy's insane, but this place is cool. And it's really cool. And I don't even know why it's cool, but it just feels cool. And I remember thinking the name was cool. And the name came about through, you know, Sinali being the patron saint of coffee. The goat herder who discovered the coffee bean, Muhammad Sabir ibn Ali. And I thought, this is what a fucking story. This is mad's pants. And so I, you know, worked out who Mark was and tapped him on the shoulder, and we had a couple of chats. The first two, he told me to fuck myself. Then about a year later, you know, I did the do, and then took Sun Ali from there to the world. And I think Mark and I have since, you know, had a few makeup dinners, and I still think it's probably one of his regrets, to be honest. Even though he's gone and do some pretty cool things, it was in my mind and remains the pioneer of that space in Australia.
Well, tell us about the evolution of St. Ali once you got your hands on it. Are there some really key moments that you can tell us about?
Yeah, well, I mean, so Sinali was about 13 months old when I got my hands on it. And at that point, you know, what I know now, we used to roast on a 5-kilo Renegade roaster, which if there are any Renegade fans out there, then you need to get your head examined. It was like using a terrible toaster. So, you know, we quickly moved to a Probat. And, you know, Probat's probably the benchmark for, you know, good roasting, but more so, you know, we were sort of old school 1958, 1962, old school barrel Probat roasters. And in this process, you know, when you do a roast, you know, roasts can vary between, I don't know, 12 minutes and 18 minutes or something. So if you do the numbers on that, you probably get three batches an hour, and you lose about 20% of weight to roast ratio. And so if you've got a 5 kilo roaster and you're getting 15 kilos an hour and you're losing 20%, you're getting 13 kilos an hour. And anyone listening who knows, some busy cafes can use that in a day, right? So it sort of dawned upon me that micro roasting as an idea was good, but what we were doing, what I'd inherited, was something more like toasting two slices of bread rather than micro roasting. Like, it was a tiny outfit, right? And so, but it took me at least five or six mistakes to realize I needed to spend resources on the bits that mattered, like green sourcing and rather than hand packing, you know. And so that journey, and by the way, it took me a while to work that out. So, you know, while I was trying to understand why the commerce of roasting coffee didn't make any sense, like it was more expensive to roast my own coffee than it was to just buy coffee, I went on this sort of evangelical tirade. I was so frustrated by the price points that coffee was at, when it was like, you know, $8 for a beer and it was like $3 for a coffee, and coffee took so much effort to make taste good and put in a cup. And then I realized that when you started digging deeper and deeper into the coffee story and the coffee narrative, as it turns out, the work that we were doing was actually probably even the least significant, because the most significant work was happening at farm level, and that we were merely custodians of the farmers. So you've got, you know, 100 pairs of hands picking cherries and sorting them out at a farm level, and then another 100 pairs of hands in between getting the coffee from A to B, and all the people moving the coffee around were making the money. The guy, people growing the money, growing the coffee, weren't making any money. And the people selling at the other end were doing okay, but the brokers in between were making the most, and they were not doing anything really. And I thought, well, it can't be that hard. So we, you know, sort of started going to farms, and now everybody goes to farms. But back then, the idea of direct trade was, you know, pretty new. And to be honest, I was so ill-prepared for going to farms that I didn't even think it through. I remember my first farm visit, I rocked up and I was kind of wearing a suit. I don't know why I was wearing a suit. I think I was wearing a suit because it's the best way to carry one, you know, because I only do carry-on luggage. So if you're going to bring a suit overseas, you sort of wear it on the plane or something. And I got picked up at the airport, and the next thing I was on a donkey on a mountain in a suit in Costa Rica or Honduras or something, I can't remember. And one advantage that I had was I spoke Spanish. So it didn't take me long to work out that the, you know, there was a farm gate price, there was a broker price, and I just started dealing directly. And we said to them back then, and the same farms we still use today, you know, like this is a flavor profile we're looking for. And if, you know, if you invest a little bit of money into a fermentation tank, and if you do this and if you do that, in fact, we'll just buy them for you, because it wasn't very expensive to us, but it was expensive to them, like a donkey's, I don't know, $500 or something, you know. But $500 to us wasn't a lot of money. And then we started getting high-quality coffee, and we could afford to pay two or three times the commodity price, because the commodity price was so low and we were getting great coffees, right? So I guess what I'm saying, to get on a plane and go to Origin at a time when going to Origin was not common. Now that it's sort of set up a bit like a circus, as you know, tour companies. But back then it was, you know, you'd bump into one or two people that you knew from around the globe. That was kind of, in hindsight, pretty cool stuff. At the time, I was just like, can't be that hard, right? Like, how hard can it be? You just go there and you knock on some doors, and that's exactly what we did, you know. And in that process, you met some interesting characters. He met some, you know, people in the cartels. They were interesting. There were lots of guns everywhere. Lots. I remember lots and lots of guns. So there was, you know, three or four or five guns in cars, two or three guns in, you know, at the hotel. That was a journey. And I mean, how can you not love that? I remember eating pork belly that was cooked in a 40-gallon drum. And tequila shots in Honduras. I mean, they're memorable times. And when you're on a farm, and I think when you eat coffee cherries off a tree, which, you know, if you haven't done, you should do. And you know, you spit out the pip, which is the coffee beans, and then you realize it's a fruit. You know, you have that. You know, you sort of always knew it was a fruit, but you didn't really think about it being a fruit. And then you think, hang on a sec. Of course, it's going to taste different if it's grown in Kenya or Costa Rica or whatever. And that sort of moment where you realize the coffee plant, given a voice, has enormous power, that could only happen through that journey, right? Now, that's what I'm saying. A lot of these days, a few of the plagiarists have come up and cut and paste and pretend to be an indie coffee micro roasting business, give me the shits, because they're just pretending. They even haven't been to a farm, even if they have good coffee. You know, some of them are smart enough to buy at least good coffee, but they really sort of haven't done the journey. And our journey back then was, or mine in particular, was counterculture. You know, I was very vocal about the big corporate companies, very vocal that, you know, a few threatened to sue me and shut me down and that kind of stuff. And I wasn't, you know, having had a legal background and training, I was not at all concerned, because everything I wasn't saying wasn't defamatory. It was honest and truthful. So I was like, well, yeah, go ahead and prove me wrong. And that's what I did. And at one point, at 1 year, I think BuzzFeed named me number one as the most pretentious thing ever out of their 24 most pretentious things. So I think I did some good work.
This episode of The Luminaries on Deep in the Weeds is proudly supported by Deputy, helping managers and staff do their best work.
Building a business is hard. I feel it as I build my business. But I can tell you one thing, that every single day, I feel very blessed for the impact our business, Deputy, has in this hospitality community and the numerous stories that we have been part of. Stories where I've heard Deputy customers who have opened new restaurants because of the cost savings they have had by implementing Deputy in their business. Being able to open new restaurant, creating new employment, new opportunities, and new connections.
For more information, go to deputy.com. You mentioned that coffee for you is transporting. Tell us about the coffee experience from your perspective and what you're trying to deliver for your customers.
So, as I said, I've got cultural sensitivities to coffee. So, you know, I don't drink Turkish coffee, but I understand it and I understand why people drink it. And there are people doing great work in that space, but often it's, you know, dark roast robusta coffee. So it's, you know, not my profile. But as an example, I just say that. For a lot of my, Italo friends, the work that we do for our fruit bombs or our, you know, fruit forward or fruit focused coffees, even though they may be coffees that we think are delicious and they're super expensive and super rare, they're like, that tastes like shit. I don't want my coffee to taste like pineapple juice or lemon juice or, you know, papaya. I want my coffee to taste like coffee. And I'd be like, well, what does that mean to you? You know, what does a coffee tasting like coffee mean? You know? And the traditional Idlo roast, Italian roast, which is, you know, Brazil, Colombia, most common coffees in the world, probably least interesting, I guess. And you're trying to get a profile which is caramel chocolates. So you're trying to celebrate sweetness without any of the bitterness. Well, if you follow that orthodox, and we have a blend called Orthodox, if you follow that orthodox sort of blend, but you start with higher grade coffees and you take the roasting slightly back so it's not quite as dark or not quite as developed. And there's an argument here about how you like your toast, you know, on a chart of 1 to 6, are you sort of warm bread or you like burnt, you know? And especially coffee was always, you know, sort of medium to light. And you know, a lot of the Americans we have at the moment, Dwayne Saracen, who is a founder of Stumptown Coffee, working for us in the US. And his view is that a lot of Australian coffees are underdeveloped, which is a polite way of saying roasted too lightly. So what I guess the long way of saying, we've got enough in our stable to tick a lot of boxes. We've got a crowd which is orthodox, which is, you know, you can't hate, you know, like if you're a snob and a coffee purist, you might think he's slightly predictable in flavor profile, but you're not going to hate it. And then we've got, you know, at the other end, Idlo Disco Blend, which is what I just described, a traditional Italian coffee made for people who are searching for those caramels and chocolates and want to cut through milk. And then all the way down to our single origin, single state program where, you know, we just released a geisha last week. And, you know, like I said, the flavor was full of fruit. And so even when it comes to mouthfeel with coffee, if you think about it, if you're an espresso drinker and of that ilk, you're wanting mouthfeel and you're talking, you know, you're talking crema and mouthfeel. But if you're a in the cup profile guy and you're drinking siphons or pour overs or batches or whatever, you're looking for flavor. And so you're looking for a more tea-like consistency. So even in mouthfeel, it's a very different thing. And rather than being, and so I guess what Sonali's always done and what I've always done, because I had this cultural sensitivity. And in the early days, even a couple of the characters that I mentioned earlier were, you know, pretty anti what the Italians were doing. I was like, well, hang on a sec. It's a journey and it's culturally relevant. So we can't say this is wrong and this is right. And I'll give you an example of what I mean when it comes to something a bit more obvious, like wine. I am probably considered a pretentious wine drinker rather than a pointy end wine drinker. And I'll tell you what I mean. So I've you know, experimented with naturals when it comes to wine, the oranges, and, you know, 1 in 10 are unbelievable and 9 in 10 are just crap. And I just can't be bothered with having a crap wine experience. So I'll, you know, and this is lazy because, you know, to navigate the crap from the good requires a lot of work. So I'll tend to order a Chablis or Pinot Noir, and I know where I'm ordering it from, and I'm pretty guaranteed to have the flavor, you know, explosion in my mouth that I want. Now, if I'm in the hands of a capable somm, and you mentioned Jess Ho earlier, so if it's Jess or Urumu and they're going to recommend a natural for me, sure, I'll run with the somm recommendation. But, and that's the same with coffee. If you want your coffee every morning as a, you know, Kickstarter and as a moment of reflection and mindfulness, you don't necessarily want a fruit bomb journey. Like, you just want a coffee that's going to taste delicious and get you going. But if it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you've got a bit of time and, you know, you're a foodie and you're sitting at a bar at our new slow bar at Sonali, and you've got our, you know, cellar project. So we've got, you know, over 100 coffees frozen, dating back a few years from different harvests, and you want to, you know, traipse through the cellar menu and choose a coffee and pay $25 for it and wait 15 minutes for it. Great, you know, but they're very different experiences, right? And I guess that's my journey with everything. Like at home, we only eat well. You know, I always say I don't want bad calories. You know, like I just don't want them. I mean, I'm too old to have calories. I'm too old to have bad calories. So whatever we're going to eat, it's going to be good. And if I want to eat crap, and sometimes I do, you know, I mean, proper junk, you know, then I'm celebrating the junk and I'm washing it down with a good old Coke, you know, which might happen once a year or twice a year. But that's the experience that I want then. So no judgment from us. And that's one of the things that I think, unfortunately, people think we are pretty judgy and pretty clicky and pretty hipster. But the truth is we're not. It's your journey. And often when I'm selling someone a piece of brewing equipment, you know, my first question is, do you have a budget? Because if you don't have a budget, well, then we can go anywhere. And if you've got a budget, then, you know, a good mock master for $400, you know, plug and play on the bench is going to give you pretty much everything you need. You know, if you, you know, start your journey there, and everyone starts their journey in coffee, actually probably most people in milk. So they're not really drinking coffee anyway. They're drinking like a coffee flavored milk product. And you know, early in their journey, they're adding sugar. So, you know, I watched my own children. My daughter's turned 19 and she always used to drink a cafe latte with one sugar. And now she's already at long max stages. And, you know, by the time she's 22, she'll be only blacks. And then she'll, you know, be tight. You know what I mean? So, you know, everyone who works for me, who's been around for long enough, no one drinks milk. And I'm like, well, that's a problem. Don't you see that? Given that 90% of people still drink milk. And we need to be tasting coffee as to how they drink it. And, you know, what's added to the complication is all the alternate milks these days. So, you know, this might taste great with soy, but not oat, and not good with almond, but not walnut, and so on and so on. So it's quite complicated, mate. There's a long answer for you.
Well, St. Ali is one of the best cafes on the planet. Well, lots of people think that starting a cafe is a good idea for them. Well, what would you say to those thinking about getting into the business?
Well, you know, it's been very kind to me, hospo and cafes, and I love it. It's, I think before I answer that question in relation to cafes, I just think business full stop. I think if you could do a personality profile test, you know, what I mean is if you can look in the mirror and you think, am I a high risk or low risk individual? Because if you're low risk or even medium risk, then I say don't do anything because you'll stay up at night time and get stomach ulcers. If you're a high risk individual, then I'm saying, yep, it's a good start because, you know, hospo's pretty high risk. Yeah, a lot of them go under. Not many of them, you know, and not many of them survive. Not many of them survive more than 3 years. There's been a lot of food and beverage venues that I think of over the last 20 years that are no longer with us. You know, very few reach, you know, iconic, classic, you know, decade status. And even fewer 20 years beyond, right? So, I mean, 20 years is our benchmark. That's what we're going for. We're 2 years out. So, and I guess you got to, so it's once you've done that assessment, you've got to, if you're going to get into the cafes, you have to love people because, you know, one of the sort of trends that happened with hipster coffee bars is that barista never spoke to customers. And then Brewster was so focused on the craft that, you know, he didn't need to talk to customers. He was just focused on the craft. And that's sort of, you know, we suffered a bit of that in the early days, but that's not the venue that I want to be in, you know. I don't necessarily want the waiter or Brewster to be my best friend, but I the human exchange and the is, you know, and the warmth and the hospitable exchange is something that I would want in my barista or server or whatever. So if you don't love people, I wouldn't get into cafes. And then I guess unless you've got a large inheritance or are keen to halve your wealth, I would be you know, treating it like I would be doing the numbers before you do anything. And then in that advice, I'd say the biggest killer for operators is occupancy costs. And in occupancy costs, I include obviously rent, but the additional occupancy costs these days, which are no longer a rounding error. But when I started out, you know, no one actually thought about electricity or gas. They were like, they came monthly, but they were like, I don't know, $500 or something. And now they're like $5,000 or something. So it's like $1,000 a week. In, you know, in juice to run the cafe, right? So that's the biggest number that you can't change. Once you've locked in those numbers, if they're too high, it's pretty hard to turn tricks unless you get lucky and you're really busy. And, you know, like there are some rentals being paid out there by some of these large groups. I think, well, you need to do 10,000 people a week because if you don't, it goes backwards pretty quickly. And then, I don't know. I think if you're a young person starting out, you need to accept that for the first year or three of your life, it's pretty much all you're going to do. And, you know, it's strange, right? Because when let's talk about sport for a minute. When someone's a Olympian or a, you know, marathon winner, I can't remember the names of the guy that broke two 2 hours for the marathon. Remember the guy's name? I don't remember it. Anyway, when you're that guy, if all you do is train and eat to train, to train to eat, to train to eat, and that's all you do, that's like respected, right? And it's like there's tiers at podiums, there's kind of like, you know, there's lots of sort of adoration. And but if you do the same in business, you're psycho and you don't know the difference in work-life balance, right? But if you want to be Melbourne's best restaurateur or Melbourne's best barman or Melbourne's best chef, you're going to do nothing but that. And you're going to do that until you are. I mean, you don't become Rene Redzepi or my favorite in Australia at the moment, Josh Nyland. I hope he's listening because that guy, I'm not a groupie, but geez, he's bloody good. I don't know if you follow his work, but that fish butchery stuff, unbelievable. Like, it's one of the reasons I want to move in Sydney. It's all he does, right? He eats, swallows, studies fish, and he works all the time. So I guess if you're going to be competitive in this environment, you need to make sure that you've got enough juice in the tank, obviously financially, but also emotionally and physically to see it through, because it's a hard game. You know, there's no easy service.
The pandemic meant that reinvention was required for everyone in the food service sector. What did you do?
I feel like you just ignored my advice. It was not the advice you wanted. hang on. Yeah, it's great. Everyone should open a cafe. Is that better? No. What did I do? So, yeah, look, my pivot story, I've told it so many times, I bore myself, so I'll try and get some enthusiasm. But I got pretty lucky with my pivot. And truthfully, if not for this, it would have been a very different pandemic for us. I was in Koh Samui, probably on my, third drink, when my best friend who owns a Legionnaires disease prevention company called Hydrochem. And what does that mean? He puts chemicals into cooling towers to make sure that Legionnaires doesn't spread. So he's an industrial chemist. And he rang me and said, hey, you got this. It was January 3rd last year. And he said, I've got this really strange phone call to tell you about. And I was like, oh, yeah, what's that? And he said, oh, I just had a phone call. One of our clients wants 25,000 litres of hand sanitizer. And to be honest with you, man, I didn't really even know what hand sanitizer was. I was just like, oh, all right. And I was sort of, why? You know, and the only time that I'd sort of used hand sanitizer was in hospitals when they sort of tell me to sanitize for a walk in to see the patient, you know, that kind of thing. And probably not even thought about what I was doing. You know, I was like, okay, I've got to spray this and walk in. Okay, gotcha. Yep, no worries. And I said, who's the client? He said it was Crown Casino. And I thought, okay, no worries. What do you want from me? He said, well, I need, I move bulk product around. I need someone to, do it with so we can make it into sort of a retail product. I'm like, yeah, well, we've got a creative team and it's pretty simple, I suspect. You know, what are the ingredients? And these are the ingredients, all that kind of stuff. And so we got onto designing this beautiful bottle. Be calm, be kind, be clean was the bottle. And then I was flying back through Singapore. And I was in Singapore and everyone was wearing a mask. And remembering, if you can remember back then, I never worn a mask in my life. I didn't even know what it was really. And I was like, why is everyone wearing a mask? And then when I landed in Melbourne, I thought to myself, I reckon Chairman Packer has spoken to Chairman Mao and this whole bloody Wuhan thing's for real, you know. So I rang Nick and I said, hey, how much ethanol do you buy a month? And he said, we buy this much. I said, well, you should buy 25 times as much. And because I reckon this whole thing's going to blow up. And we had a little discussion about it and we decided it was worth a punt. And we did it. And then for about 4 weeks, maybe a little bit longer, maybe 5 weeks, we had 96 of our staff working 7 days, 3 shifts, making sanitizer. And we ended up selling sanitizer to the Royal Flying Doctors, to the Army, to Victoria Police, to anyone. And no one had it and we had it. And I had people, had close friends begging to come by and pick up a bottle at home and that kind of thing. And everybody was in this weird panic. And we were just working. I was working 90 hours a week. I couldn't panic because I was just working all the time. I was just trying to fill orders that by the time we'd filled all the orders, the panic was over, if you know what I mean. And I was just like, all right, what's this Corona thing all about? You know, that kind of thing. And but in that process, mate, what happened was because so many people came to our website, at one point on our website there were 2,500 visitors, which is phenomenal. And we grew our database. And so then I figured, well, we had the goods, people trusted the brand enough to buy sanitizer from us. Why don't we just sell other stuff? And we started selling other stuff of people that we liked. Actually, Jess Ho helped out a lot in the beginning. She hooked us up with a whole bunch of, you know, cool little chef artists and makers like City Larder. And we started selling cool products like that. And then sort of overnight, it seems, but maybe not overnight, over a period of about 6 months, we became an online sort of pantry. And we went from moving 1,000 boxes a month online to 12,000 boxes of stuff online. And every time we hit a hurdle, so, you know, the most embarrassing hurdle was I watched my coffee go from Port Melbourne to Clayton to Redfern to Newcastle, back down to St Kilda, delivered to a customer. And you can see the tracking thing, and I was just like, this is so fucked. And then I thought, we've got 15 trucks anyway. Why don't we just put the trucks on the road and deliver our own stuff? So I put the trucks on the road, and you know, we got all our baristas and stuff just delivering. And then we made this promise that we would deliver anywhere, including Mildura and you know anywhere in Victoria. So we did, and we grew the business. So you know, come to the other end of, I think it's end of lockdown 6 on Friday. We've now got a very different business to the one we had and probably one we prefer. We've got a, you know, online presence, which is, I've never compared it to anything else, but I'd say it'd be second to none. We've got a whole bunch of products we've, you know, come up with and released, like a cascara soda, a cascara Negroni, a fresh iced coffee product, etc. We've got a whole bunch of artisan makers that we sell for and trust us to sell for. Even some of the ones you can't get, like Tom Seraph and the hummus guy. And we've got our traditional wholesale business, you know. So it was quite the pivot, and it was continual pivot. And I always say that you probably don't have any Rocky fans out there, but Rocky 1 was still my favorite movie ever. And maybe not Rocky 5, but Rocky 1. And when the Sly Stallone's in round 12 and he goes down and Apollo Creed thinks it's all over and then he gets up again. And Apollo Creed, the look on his face where he thinks, you've got to be fucking kidding me. And then Rocky wins at round 12. That's what it felt like every day for 18 months. It felt like round 12 of Rocky 1. Yeah. Thank God we're opening.
That is extraordinary. Coffee has underpinned everything you've done in your incredible career. What is it that you love about what you do?
Well, you know, I sort of, you know, if it was about just making cash, right, I sort of wish I was interested in tech or fintech or something because, you know, those guys are working out of a garage one day and then they're in the papers at $39 billion the next day. So it's not about making money because I would have moved, right? I'm a very sensorial guy. I just love food and beverage and I love the makers. I love everything about it, you know. So whenever all our family holidays are always about restaurants. So, you know, I remember the most beautiful experience we had and maybe some would say it's cliche, but it's just the truth, you know. Rene Redzepi, Noma, whenever he comes to Australia, comes to Sonali, and I tried to get a booking there at Noma before it moved for 5 of us, but the three of us were kids, you know, like I think we were 12, 10 and 8 or something, and I couldn't get a booking, so I hate pulling favours. But so then I rang him, I said, look, we're going to be in your hood, any chance for a table? Of course, no problem. Yep, of course, we'll sort it out. And we rocked up to Noma and, you know, we're standing outside the Noma sign and and taking a photo, and then Renee opens the door and welcomes the family to Noma, and all the service staff and all the chef are in a row, welcoming us in. And my kids thought I was like a king or something. They're like, "Oh, you're like a king. You're like a king." I'm like, "Yeah, man, I'm like a king." And then Renee came out each course, and each course he would describe what he was going to do next and how he was going to do it to my children, who were, kids, proper kids, like 12, 10 and 8. And then after the, 3-hour lunch, we went back a house and we played foosball table soccer with him, in the kitchen. And then we went to his fermentation room, and it was like a 5-hour journey. And to this day, that's all the kids talk about. That experience, that being able to provide that to people and connecting so deeply, so quickly through food, an exchange of food or coffee, that's what I love. And, I've got a, this was a word your young listeners won't know, but I've got a pretty deep Rolodex. My Rolodex is all through just hosting people in my various venues. I mean, I'll tell you a crazy story. A guy called, he'll probably kill me for telling you this, but a guy called Sahim Althani, who's one of the kids, I think he called them princes, one of the princes of the royal family in Qatar. He's a crazy coffee nerd, and through his concierge, the hotel he was staying in, he reached out to, so the concierge is a guy called Ronnie, and Ronnie rang me and said he had a super VIP who wanted some, private lessons and some, coffee tuition. And he had a barista in mind, and, he used to work for us at the time, and, he specified the entire thing, right? And I said to Ronnie, "Who is this guy, man? Like, this is crazy." And he said, "Oh, I can't tell you, but, super VIP." I said, "Okay, cool." So we priced it up, and sure enough, I was there to greet him. And it was, and the weird thing about the booking was that it was at 11 p.m. And I was like, who the hell has a fucking, masterclass 11 p.m., right? And, of course, it was Ramadan. So it was, I didn't connect any of these dots at the time. I was there, and I was, greeting him, and he was with a guy called Andy, who is now in hindsight, he's head of security, but at the time I thought they were a couple, or they were best friends, or I had no idea what was going on. And then I worked out who he was. Anyway, long story short, he came to my wedding, and we became really good friends, and all through coffee. And like I said, the chili peppers, you tell me any other profession that gives you that kind of access to experiences. And tables, so what do I like most about my job? Those connections.
Well, Salvatore, I know you've got so many more stories, and perhaps we'll have to catch up again, but we've absolutely loved having you on the Luminaries on Deep in the Weeds today to hear just a few of them. Please keep in touch, and we'll catch up again soon.
Thanks for having me, mate. I appreciate it.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we take a deep dive into the lives of the incredible people who ply their trade in the food and hospitality sector.
Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen.
Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds Podcast, or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au.
Stay safe and be well.